Cloudcast Media presents from the massive studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. This is The Cloudcast with Aaron Delp and Brian Gracely, bringing you the best of cloud computing from around the world.
Good morning, good evening, wherever you are, and welcome back to The Cloudcast, coming to you live from the massive Cloudcast studios here in Raleigh, North Carolina. Aaron, it is the end of 2016. It is time once again for our sort of end of the year wrap-up show. How are you doing, man?
Good, man. Good. So the big thing, and we'll go into the bunch of the housekeeping stuff here in a second. Are you running yet?
No. So we'll get to that point. I was running, and then, the holidays hit, and I kind of got behind a little bit. And as people who listened to yesterday's show may have known, this may be a little bit of day two of both of us sounding nasally and drony. And I don't think either one of us are in the best of health at this point today, but we'll try and make the best of it.
Maybe that's just an indication of old age as well. But so what we're talking about here is, as we're, for the new listeners, we do a run every year. It's in February, the Krispy Kreme Challenge. And we raise money for the North Carolina Children's Home, which is the charity for the race. And we've done very well over the years from a donation standpoint, haven't done as well from a running standpoint. But I've decided now my knees are unfortunately to the point now where, you know what, I'm not even training this year. I'm just going to run the damn thing cold. I've decided.
All right.
So
I like it.
So
yeah. I realized, other than maybe the very first show or the second show, we've never really done a formal introduction to who we are. You know, a lot of shows will go, "Hey, that's over there across the mic is Steve and John." And like, we never introduce ourselves. And the reason that might be useful is because we were up about 70% in terms of listeners this year. So, I guess by means of introduction, my name is Brian Gracely. The guy on the other microphone is Aaron Delp. If you're not sure who we are, I'm sure you picked it up at some point.
Ryan's the guy that's been on the show for quite a while now, and I'm the one who's only recently gotten back onto the show. So
we've always done the show as we always said, we're two guys that don't live in Silicon Valley, but we try and stay up to date with it, and hopefully we help you guys stay up to date with it. So, we're always open to ideas. If you have topics you'd like us to cover, if you'd like us to have a certain guest on, shoot us a DM or an email or something like that. You can always reach us at show@thecloudcast.net. So a couple of little housekeeping things that we do every year that people seem to like. So I always run through some numbers for us. So first off, need to thank everybody who listens to the show, tells a friend, whether it's, moms and dads or, friends and so forth. Need to thank everybody who sponsored the show at some point this year. So Intel and the Cloud for All initiative, ServiceNow have both been great sponsors all year long. So thank you very much to them. And Aaron, we did 50 shows this year. So it's been a right about the number we do. We tend to be sort of every week, but this year we did get through 50 shows. And I think we only did really one event. We did the All Things Open event where we did a bunch of shows in 1 week, but otherwise pretty consistent.
And that's an interesting trend too, because it seems like no matter what we do year over year, we come in at about 50 shows.
Yeah.
And a couple of years ago, we were doing a lot of conferences and we both had jobs at the time that allowed us that opportunity. You know, we do have day jobs here. And we were able to do a lot of that, and we were asked to attend a lot of shows and do podcasts from shows. I'll be honest with you. I don't know how you feel about it, but I certainly have kind of mixed feelings about the shows at times, in the fact that it turns the shows into just a complete grind.
Yeah.
We've gotten very mixed feedback over dumping a bunch of shows into the feed. Do you do them all at once? Do you do a couple a week and spread that out over a number of weeks? Do you just not do, shows at all? And so, that's probably been the most contentious thing we've done, now that we've improved our audio quality, because that's by far and away the number one complaint we've ever gotten.
Right.
Once we improve the audio quality, the probably the number two feedback thing is whether to do shows or not. And I'll be honest with you, We've kind of gone both ways, and I don't know what 2017 is going to look like. At this point, I would certainly like to continue to do the shows, but maybe not do as many. Maybe we're doing, I don't know, 2 to 3 to maybe 5 tops at a show, and put them in the feed slowly over time is probably my preference going forward. But if anybody has feedback on that, we would certainly love to hear.
Yep. Yeah, it's always tricky because the sound quality is not usually as good because it's hard to find a quiet spot. And sometimes the shows are, they're not timely anymore once the event is over. And, you know, so there's always that trade-off. But yeah, any feedback is welcome from people. you know, a couple of interesting things that we sort of track. We look at the most popular shows of the year. And what was interesting this year was, you know, the topics of the most popular shows. So serverless came into the fold. That was one of the most popular ones for a number of shows. Containers was a big deal. DevOps was a big deal. But what was really interesting this year, and we'd never seen this before, was all the shows that were the most popular shows were actually the highest ranked of all time as well. So I think that sort of lends itself towards the show's growing. So thanks to everybody who's listening. But some of those topics, you know, I think it's because there's just, it's moving so fast. There's so much kind of signal to noise ratio out there. You know, so there's a lot of people that are trying to find some clarity and, you know, maybe with some of the guests we had on, it provided a little bit of clarity. So it was an interesting phenomenon this year. Usually older shows continue to have more listens long-term. This year was very different. The other thing that was, we always sort of track. So at the end of last year, we had around, so we track of the guests that come on the show, how much money they've taken in terms of VC funding. And typically we do it as VC funding after they've been on the show. So we don't sort of historically count stuff that they had previously. And then we look at M&A. And some of the M&A numbers are always a little bit weird because they're not always disclosed, but we sort of find out some things through back channels and stuff. So as of last year, our number combined M&A for guests and funding for the guests was around $5 billion. At the end of 2016, the number was about $7.5 billion. So it was roughly $2.5 billion, a little north of $2.5 billion in VC funding that guests had received after coming on the show, and around $5 billion in M&A for guests. And then we've seen about 25 acquisitions. So it's always fun to sort of track that, you know, in terms of, you know, guests who have come on the show, things that we've been able to sort of see. And so that's cool. We're still seeing a certain amount of activity going on in the market from that perspective. But I think that's something we're going to talk about in more detail here today.
Yeah, absolutely. And in addition to that, we kind of made, you know, again, maybe it's the longevity of it going into the seventh year now, but we've made several watch lists, you know, whether it's blogs or podcasts. And it's always interesting whenever we get put in a blog category, because I'm like, huh, really?
Yeah.
Maybe we should start blogging.
No.
But it's really nice to see some of the recognition out there in the industry. And you know, it's been in some really nice lists and some really good companies. So I feel very fortunate to be a part of the community. And it goes back to the roots of all of this. You know, at the end of the day, we started this a long time ago to help the community out. And being recognized in some of those lists is for me very rewarding and helps us feel that we were on the right path way back when.
Yep. Yep. So, so a couple of last sort of housekeeping things here. You know, we talked about serverless shows being really popular. We had the guys from Engineers and Coffee. We did OpenWhisk. We've talked a little bit about some things like Lambda and some of the other ones. Iron.io was on. And at one point, we had toyed with the idea of doing the serverless cast. And you know, we did all the basic things. We did all the plumbing. We got the serverlesscast.io domain. We made a new logo for the show. We made a Twitter feed. And you know, I think what we sort of realized, part of it was timing, just what was going on in our lives. But I think we sort of realized that the prospect of trying to create a new community over something that it might be its own thing, like serverless computing maybe should be the next completely different thing, but we're not sure. And so I think you and I sort of decided after a bunch of discussion that it might be best to do serverless shows, and we'll sort of call them the serverless cast. But we're going to keep them in this feed as opposed to creating a brand new feed that somebody has to go find and listen to and update. And so I think the way to read
very
that,
similar to what we did with the mobile cast once upon a time as well.
Yeah.
So it's, think of it that way. Is what we're looking to do is, instead of folks going and finding us at different places, is have the feed be the all in one spot to catch everything, but you may start to see different shows in that feed over time.
Right. So, and hopefully the simplest way for you to find them, I mean, obviously the title should be pretty obvious. Usually they'll say the Serverless Cast. But you know, if you're just visually looking at stuff, the Cloudcast logo is white, you know, has some red letterings in it. The Serverless Cast one has a red background. And then we've been thinking about, and I may be doing this, either one of us may be doing this from time to time, maybe biweekly. We never do news on the show. We used to do a news show back in the day. We would, you know, periodically, quarterly, monthly do a news show. We may do a, you know, like once a week, maybe like on a Sunday or a Monday morning or something, quick 10 minutes of, hey, news from the week, maybe stuff that you really should pay attention to that may not have been, you know, super high on a feed somewhere. So you may see that. And if we do that, you'll see that as a sort of a blue logo in your feed. So hopefully we'll make it very simple for you to find this stuff, and hopefully it won't be, too distracting to anybody, but that's kind of the state of where we think we're going to go with the serverless stuff. And if we get it wrong and it turns out to explode and be really its own thing, we may, split it off into its own show.
Yeah, makes sense. Absolutely. Cool.
So how do you want to go about kind of doing the recap stuff versus the prediction stuff? We've done this in multiple ways in the past. What do you think we got to try and do today?
Well, I think probably one of the biggest things is almost a little bit of recap of the year, in a couple different areas, and then kind of go into their predictions from there. It's interesting to me, the state of the VC market, the state of M&A, the state of tech acquisitions this year, because we did, I mean, we had a very noticeable slowdown.
Yep.
In the industry. And, you know, when we started this, it was really cloud was just taking off. And whether you want to call it converged infrastructure, whether you want to call it, you know, IaaS, PaaS, all these other different acronyms that there's been over the years, it feels to me like this year there was just a basic shift in the market for a bunch of different reasons. And you're starting to see your very traditional, you know, commoditization of everything, consolidation of everything. And that makes me wonder, you know, and all, you know, that's why I kind of wanted to do the recap before we went into the predictions to kind of show everyone exactly what we're seeing. And so, like, what are some of the things you've seen in the tech acquisitions, M&A, IPO kind of things, Brian?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think, you know, when we used to do this, some of the big trends we were seeing from VC funding, you know, software defined, a lot of stuff, you know, software defined storage, networking, and so forth used to get big funding, that people, let me rephrase it. Like, we used to see a lot of funding of people trying to sort of reinvent the mousetrap or build a better mousetrap. Like, it really wasn't a reinvention of how something fundamentally worked. It was, you know, just kind of building a better version of it. I think when we looked at this year, there were kind of a couple of trends that we saw, right? So we saw, and we'll just use a couple of examples. So for example, we saw Oracle bought NetSuite for something like, I mean, it was north of $10 billion, I think. Maybe it was closer to $15 billion. You know, that's one of those things where you sort of go, okay, you can look at that as the beginning of sort of consolidation around business-centric SaaS applications, right? We saw this, you know, back in the day when Oracle was buying PeopleSoft and you know, all these other sort of companies. Like, we tend to see business productivity stuff get consolidated. I think we're starting to see that sort of around the SaaS space. And, you know, there's a lot of talk about people saying, you know, will Salesforce go on a buying spree to sort of consolidate around stuff? Will things like Pegasystems, which is a CRM system, Workday, a bunch of those types of companies, you know, maybe Microsoft buying LinkedIn, we're starting to see, you know, the business productivity stuff, A, it's moved to SaaS, which makes total sense because it is very much a commodity thing. And, you know, the companies that can then take that to market very well and do that, kind of consolidating around those things.
Well, and also let me add this, for Oracle in particular, just the fact that they changed their acquisition pattern says a lot as well. Oracle for years was known as, you know, the company that picked the bones. They would acquire somebody, in a space that was about to go under, acquire them really cheap, acquihire them, you know, take some of the assets and, you know, buy it cheap and move on. And because they had enough power in their, all of their existing customer accounts that they could force it into profit.
Yep.
But with the, like with the NetSuite thing, you're actually seeing them buying stuff at a premium and looking to expand into a different market. So a very, very different acquisition pattern for Oracle in particular that for me was probably the most telling thing of all of that.
Right, right. Yeah, that was – so that was one. You know, obviously we saw the – while the deal was announced in 2015, we saw the closing of the, you know, Dell acquiring EMC slash VMware slash Pivotal slash VirtuStream, all the companies that were part of the EMC sort of federation. You know, to me, that is very much a signaling of, you know, consolidation of the hardware industry. You know, VMware, yep. VMware essentially being, you know, part of the new hardware industry. But, you know, I think, and we've heard this on other shows, we've heard this kind of through what comes out of Dell and those guys, like they fully believe that that market segment, you know, essentially selling hardware, whether it's into you know, corporate data centers or whether it's into colo providers and MSPs and so forth, is essentially a flat market, and it's all about not so much growing the pie anymore. It's about taking share from other people, and you know, so that's a, I think that's a huge piece in the, you know, pure hardware consolidation or that segment of the market, you know, in terms of what's going on and whether there's, you know, it'll be interesting to see what happens there, because now as a private company, you can't necessarily tell how well they're doing. They only, you know, give away a certain amount of stuff in their financial disclosures.
Yeah. Yeah. Very true. Very true.
And then, so consolidation is never too much fun to talk about. But there were some, you know, there were some stuff going on. We saw like Nutanix, for example, went IPO. That was an interesting, Nutanix was a company that for a long time, people have been waiting for them to IPO, you know, been growing as a company, although, you know, growing in the sense of, it's not purely software. Although I think that's, I would argue, and tell me if you think I'm wrong, like, I think that's mostly where their value is around their software. But it's a difficult business to really, really grow because it follows a lot of the same sort of channel economics sort of models as well. So what, I mean, what was your take on Nutanix and the IPO market and some of those things?
No, I think actually it's a pretty fair assessment right there about the value in that is definitely in the special sauce that they're bringing. And at the end of the day, what are they doing? They're trying to do purpose built, you know, hardware software combination of infrastructure to really make folks' lives easier, specifically around virtualization. And they'll say that they want to expand out into a bunch of other different areas, but I mean that's where the market is today, or at least that's where their bread and butter is today.
Right.
So no, it's definitely, it's probably something that needed to happen. And, you know, they were probably faced with no other choice but then to IPO because of the VC, you know, the VC funding rounds just not being nearly as warm as they were earlier in the year or last year even. What's interesting to me though, too, is you can take Nutanix and kind of say, okay, if the secret sauce is in the software, you know, it very much did become a software eating the world this year. You know, what there's a bunch of different M&A activities that almost made you scratch your head slightly. But then if you kind of really step back and analyze it, you're like, huh, okay, there's some interesting dots to connect here. And you made some notes on that one, Brian. Why don't you take us through that one?
Yeah, I mean, there was a, you know, we've all heard the software is eating the world kind of mantra. I thought there was a couple that were interesting. So Unilever, which is a, you know, huge consumer packaged goods, competes with, you know, Johnson & Johnson and Procter & Gamble and all those sort of folks. They acquired Dollar Shave Club. And it was interesting because, you know, forget about, you know, what Dollar Shave Club makes. I mean, they're in the, you know, the razors and, you know, kind of health, you know, for men's health type of stuff. But it's very different business model in terms of it is a direct to consumer business. And it's a software centric business in terms of the interaction is via the web. They're trying to personalize it to you. They're trying to do repeat sales. You know, it's all very, you know, change the business model, change the distribution model. So I thought that was very interesting. It's, you know, you take Unilever, which is a, you know, competing for grocery store shelf space business and now trying to be in the, you know, sort of millennial style order stuff via an app on your phone. So I thought that was an interesting, you know, big deal. It was, you know, north of $1 billion.
Well, and it's also interesting. Again, it goes into this. I like that what you said about the direct to consumer model here, because we are seeing that more and more. I mean, yeah, you know, we both have kids.
Yep.
And I don't know about your wife, but my wife, you know, she loves, you know, Dollar Shave Club, Stitch Fix, all these other things. And I feel like every other day there's a new freaking box turning up at my door with, you know, some kind of service that either the kids have purchased or my wife has purchased. And it's interesting to me to see these very traditional companies trying to embrace, I'm not even going to say successfully just yet, but definitely trying to embrace this new consumer model. Yeah. That is very interesting to me. And it is almost, you know, SaaS at a very different consumer level.
Yeah. I mean, it gets down to, like, I use this expression sometimes and, you know, people can, you know, dispute it or whatever. Like, you know, we talk about digital transformation. I think the simplest way to think about what is digital transformation is, it's like, you know, take your customers, take your business, and just put the internet between those two things. And I don't mean, you know, put a website out there. I mean, like, that is your distribution channel. And if you think about that and what that means and how you're going to collect data from those interactions and how you're going to use it to refine your business, you know, it does change a lot of things for, you know, it changes storefronts. It changes the number of retail banks you have. It changes, you know, a lot of industries. And I think we're going to see more and more of this. A couple of other examples of this, you know, Walmart, obviously Walmart has walmart.com, but they acquired a company called jet.com, in the summertime. It was about a $3 or $4 billion acquisition, you know, in essence, them trying to amp up their online retail presence, against Amazon. So, you know, a lot of this is going to be retail driven because of what Amazon does. Another example of this was, you know, GE Digital. So everybody knows about GE and Predix, and we see commercials nowadays, them talking about them being an industrial company and a software company. They essentially bought a company called ServiceMax, which does field services. So, you know, repairing stuff and out there, you know, fixing eventually the Internet of Things, but it's a SaaS model for doing that. You know, so it's, how do I do something that is very people intensive, physical intensive, location intensive, and bring a SaaS model to that. And so I think, you know, we're going to see more and more of these. I think we'll see something along the lines of, like, instead of us always, you know, going like, oh, okay, tech company A acquired tech company B, it's going to be, you know, company I've known for 30 or 40 years acquiring tech company. How does that all come into play? And we're seeing, you know, tech companies become very focused, not around tech, but around vertical specialization of, you know, tech towards a certain industry and so forth. I think we'll start to see that trend more and more.
Well, and another interesting trend before you go into the last one as well is, so in all the ones you just mentioned, you know, or most of the ones you just mentioned here, when we're talking about the acquisition of most SaaS companies, they tend to be in the billions.
Yeah.
If you talk about, you know, what we're used to of, like, infrastructure companies or some of these more plumbing based companies, if you will, that we've been covering for years and years, what we've actually seen is, you know, those go in the tens of millions to maybe hundreds of millions, right? We haven't had a lot of $1 billion acquisitions. And so it's also super interesting to me to kind of go, okay, you know, where is the investment value and where are the big acquisitions happening? They're all SaaS based.
Right. Right. Well, and I think we've seen that from talking to various VCs. You know, we would talk to them at events, we would talk to them on the side and they would look at, you know, we'll just use examples, like people would go, well, you know, Mesosphere, for example, got $70 million in funding, I think, earlier in the year. And, you know, whether that's a good amount of money or not a good amount of money is irrelevant. But then they sort of go like, well, how does that open source business model work? Like, the software is being developed in the open source. We're paying, you know, we're investing money at a high premium. How am I going to get that money back? How are they going to turn that into revenue? And, you know, I think without me being biased, being, you know, working for Red Hat, I think a lot of people go like, well, you know, will there be other companies that build the Red Hat business model? And I don't know, you know, it hasn't necessarily happened. But I think, you know, like you take somebody like Adrian Cockcroft, who was a VC, you know, he's been a guest on the show, friend of the show. And, you know, he sort of realizes like, hey, maybe I don't want to be on the VC side. Maybe I should be back on the technology side of, you know, being associated with those SaaS companies and other stuff. So I think there's going to be a lot of reckoning that has to go on in the VC community, and we may see them, you know, pulling money out of the infrastructure space and putting it much more into autonomous driving or whatever. And we'll get into that in more
right.
details.
Yeah. Yep. And the last data point before we kind of get into the predictions here. So I actually, you know, personal shout out to Drew over at Capital One. Drew, we've got to get you on the show, you know, in January or February. But met Drew, who works at Capital One at AWS conference. And Capital One, for those that don't know, gave away one of the Echo Dots at AWS reInvent to all of the full attendees. So 25,000 Echo Dots were given away. And, you know, at first everyone kind of scratches their head and go, why would a credit card company give away Echo Dots? But, you know, it comes down to culture. It comes down to developing Alexa skills. It comes down to like they had a skill that you can actually load up on the Echo Dot of, you know, you can check your credit card balance and all of these other things. And it's a really neat, again, software eating the world culture shift that is happening. And when you see things like that, you're like, that is a new pattern that is developing that is super interesting. And it's a culture shift in our industry.
Yep. Yeah, no, it's, you know, the sponsorships were always driven by tech companies, and now they're being driven by a tech company that you don't think is a tech company, right? Like you think of them as a credit card company, but in reality, they're a tech company. So yeah, no, it's, again, sometimes we only point out data points, but you know, it sort of falls in this pattern of going, if there's enough of these data points, you know, you sort of have to pay attention, or maybe you want to see the early data points, and that's going to give you a sense of where things are going. So, yep. So we sort of broke down the prediction stuff into three areas, and we'll see how many we get through. We had some of it was around technology, some of it was around the economy of things that might happen in 2017, depending on if the economy goes well or doesn't go well. And then we sort of said politics, not because we want to get political at all, but just because the reality is we're going to have new leadership in Washington. There's a new regime who has a very different sort of philosophy on things than we've had over the last 8 years. So, you know, the life of this show has been in the previous, you know, political leadership, and now we've got new. So we may want to sort of look at what that could mean, not necessarily, you know, taking a political stance on this. So, so you want to jump in on the technology stuff?
Yeah. So we talked about this, you know, somewhat on the last show that we recorded and published yesterday, but the number one thing that I think was the really big shift this year and will be, you know, continue into 2017 is this relationship between enterprises and public cloud. You know, how does this evolve? And I'll start with my personal take on it. It is a little bit of a meet in the middle. As we kind of discussed on the last show, selling into the enterprise is all about relationships and how does something kind of grow? And it tends to be this kind of grassroots, start at the bottom, grow to some kind of critical mass, but without some kind of executive buy-in at the top, nothing necessarily moves forward. And some of the, you know, AWS in particular, but some of the other public cloud companies, I put Google in that bucket as well. They were really good at the grassroots. They were really good at embracing developers. But that getting that executive buy-in at the top or having those relationships in the enterprise was where they've always struggled. And so, you know, this meet in the middle approach is something I really do think that both the enterprise and public cloud will figure out so that there is a nice middle ground and a way to kind of move forward in a positive way in public cloud. And it doesn't need to be so much of the battle of, you know, hybrid cloud versus on-prem versus public cloud things that we've been seeing over the years. I think the dust will really finally start to settle on something like that. What are your thoughts on it?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think, you know, every startup we ever talk to, you know, is enamored with how cool their technology is. And, you know, the new stuff is better than the old stuff. And I think what we always run into is, you know, getting an order, just the basic block and tackling of taking an order, being able to show a price list and do stuff to the enterprise, you know, is stuff that they don't think about, but is ever so important. I think we're going to start seeing this trend towards, the public cloud providers are going to have to figure out how to do that, because, you know, we've both been around enterprise tech forever. Like, the best technology doesn't always win. Sometimes it's the easiest, the order, the one that's already on your ELA, the one that, somebody will bend over backwards to do some, you know, unexpected kind of integration with something that you have. And those are hard things to repeat. But they are the things that enterprises tend to buy about, because you're not dealing with startups. You're dealing with people that are trying to build long careers and are trying to think about how technology is going to work for 10 years. So I think we're going to see kind of an enterprisization of the public cloud. You know, that's a bad word, but, essentially like having to deal with the irregularities of how the enterprise buys, how they make decisions and so forth.
It's not just public cloud either. Like, to give you another, for instance, a good friend of the show and a good friend of ours that lives here in town, I won't name names per se, but works for Dropbox. Yep. And just randomly ran into him at Chick-fil-A the other day, and we were sitting around talking for a while, and this is one of those things I'm sure happens in Silicon Valley all the time, but here in Raleigh, this stuff like this doesn't happen a whole lot. But we actually were talking for a little while about the exact same challenge that Dropbox is facing to a certain extent as well, of how do you get Dropbox into the enterprise, how do you continue to grow the Dropbox business, and so we're talking about public cloud here specifically, but you could probably say this about almost any SaaS offerings or anything else where, like you were saying earlier, this digital transformation of putting the internet in between the customers and the company. Yeah. This is just a trend we're going to continue to see.
Right, right. Well, and the other thing is, I think some of the cost savings or cost value or ROI things from the public cloud sound great when you're starting from scratch. You know, don't build a data center because it'll cost you $40 million to get started, and you want to get started right now. And, I don't know that the everyday IT person or even some of the IT leadership that's in place in a lot of places today thinks in that mindset. And I think there's going to be some sort of re-justification of how costs get explained and discussed and stuff in the sense of public cloud or hybrid cloud kind of justifications. Cause it's easy to sort of, explain away things when it's just, bad versus good or completely new versus old. But, when you have that mix of what do you do, I think it's tougher for people to sort of justify, it's not just going to be get rid of all your data centers and move. It's going to be, yep, how do I explain that? So, that'll be interesting. Yep.
Let's move on. Containers. And as we're kind of hitting, if you notice, like what was our popular shows, we're kind of hitting all of those in our predictions here. What a containers ecosystem. What's your thoughts on the containers ecosystem? That we've got so many players here, but at the same time, we're starting to see somewhat of a consolidation of them. Like for instance, Cluster HQ, the Flocker folks, a couple days before Christmas, unfortunately, kind of ceased operations, and we're starting to see definitely a consolidation in the ecosystem. But what's your thoughts on the container ecosystem right now?
So I think it's a couple of things. I think, if we went back and did looked at our show a year ago, the joke was always, hey, every event is Docker, 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 right? And they own the brand, they own the hype, they owned all that stuff. And you made a comment that you didn't think Docker had gone through the trough of disillusionment yet. And this was a year ago. I think this year there was a lot of disillusionment about Docker specifically, but I think on the flip side, there was quite a bit of growth around sort of alternative, non-Docker centric container stuff. So we saw, huge growth in Kubernetes. Kubernetes is now probably four times as many, contributors, amount of contributions around the container ecosystem. And Docker is, looking at you know, I mean, there was some talk at one point of, will there be a Docker fork? You know, we saw Docker contribute this containerd thing to the well, maybe it'll be OCI, but I mean, like, sort of their underlying runtime and standard kind of becoming more commoditized. And so I feel like the container ecosystem has kind of broadened to where it's not just Docker. And I think some of the, you know, the challenges of containers are getting solved by other areas, and people aren't so enamored with Docker as they were, you know, at the end of 2015, but they still like the container concept. It just maybe isn't being driven by the same Pied Piper as it was before.
Yeah. Well, and to take this, you know, the container concept versus the ecosystem, one step further for a second, the way I've kind of seen this over the years is as we've had this transformation from OpenStack, CloudStack and VMs as the, you know, the composable object, if you will, it made perfect sense to move that one step further into containerization. But what's happening here is, the applications themselves, at least for me and the customers that I've talked to, haven't actually changed all that much. It's still stateful apps. It's not necessarily the true 12-factor apps that are out there. If you almost had a timeline where you had VMware and virtualization all the way on the left and true 12-factor apps all the way on the right, what we've started to do is move down from the left towards the right, and OpenStack, CloudStack, you know, IaaS kind of vendors, if you will, back then was that first step to the right, and then Docker and containers is the next step to the right. But it almost feels like Kubernetes and I would include actually Mesos and Marathon in this bucket as well, seems to be that right middle ground, if you will, in between. You know, most enterprises that I talk to don't want to go full 12-factor.
Yeah.
They don't want to completely reinvent the wheel. They don't want to rewrite everything. Like you were saying, Leonard, if you're building net new, great, but most aren't. Most are an evolution of the last version of what they're doing. And containerization is just enough, the exact same way virtualization was just enough. And so what you're seeing is a progressive move to the right, but certainly not as much or as fast as most of the ecosystem vendors want that are out there. And it'll be a baby step to the right and a baby step to the right and a baby step to the right. Will we ever get to true 12-factor apps? Maybe. But I think that that's a much longer progression that is, you know, we can be talking about that in the prediction show in another 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
That's something we need to talk about today. But I think the key there is everything's still stateful. Everything isn't that different.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. I think, I hear it from people all the time. They still say, look, you know, the number of, legacy, stateful, whatever, you know, apps, in comparison as a ratio to the number of net new ones that I'm going to build is something like 100 to 1, 1,000 to 1, depending on the size of the company. There are some very cool things going on around some stateless apps and 12-factor stuff and so forth. And that shift will happen over time. But it's not something that people are building in mass volume. They're building some, they're doing some stuff. It's part of the trend of, you know, you build small, you kind of iterate. I think we're going to see, you know, look, every platform we've ever seen in the past, whether they were telephony platforms or application platforms or whatever, they all eventually, the ones that stay in business and the ones that, quote unquote, you know, kind of win or gain traction, they kind of go to where the money is. And we've always said, you know, the money in applications is always around the data, which means that somehow you've got to be able to address statefulness, whatever that means. So I think we're seeing that happen in the container ecosystem as well, is that more and more people realize, you know, it is a platform game. Your platform has to be able to support old stuff as well as it supports new stuff. And, the higher up the stack you're providing value, the better. The down low at the container level is pretty commoditized. And I think that happened more and more in 2016 than we've ever seen before.
Yep. So let's move on because we've got a lot to get through here.
But, sure.
So I will admit, though, this is the next one that, you know, if I'm maybe slightly down on containers, I completely admit I'm a complete fanboy of serverless. I'm just going to go on record and just go ahead and say it, even though it probably will be a niche, and it probably still needs to go through the trough of disillusionment. Maybe this will be the year for that. And maybe it is, because people are starting to find out the limitations, and you know, it isn't the end all be all for a lot of things. But I will say this, I'm super excited about serverless, because for me, this is the greenfield architecture, especially if you're going to do like an IoT front end with a serverless back end. Like, this just feels like a proper new architecture, custom designed for the need. Like, you know, we have a lot of architectures that kind of rise up and you're kind of like, well, what problem is that ultimately solving? And we have a lot of solutions out there looking to solve problems sometimes. But I feel like, you know, serverless personally does, and IoT certainly does. And that's something we're going to get into here a little bit more. But this is the one that I want to explore the most in 2017. Serverless is just a fascinating concept to me. What's your thoughts on it?
Yeah, no, obviously we've been super interested in this for a while now. We almost made a whole show out of it. I think you hit the nail on the head, which is if you look ahead a couple of years and you say, you know, the whole IaaS thing, or even part of the PaaS thing, was like, how do we sort of migrate some existing stuff into a new model? So like public cloud or whatever it was, like it was fine. It did what it did. But if you say, like, look, we're now going to be dealing with a class of computing problems that are going to be really different, you know, whether they're IoT sort of sensor stuff where you're getting trillions and trillions of updates, or you've got to keep track of, you know, hundreds of millions of devices or whatever, that sort of thing, you had to think about it really differently. And I think the thing that really always appealed to us about serverless was, and you know, we sort of have to acknowledge that a lot of the serverless stuff sort of gets biased by what Lambda does, is, you know, it is almost completely ops-less. I mean, at least from what you see as a developer, and the pricing model is completely, you know, utility. It's only what you use. It's not, you're not paying for idle time. You're not paying for, and so, you know, things like capacity planning and things like, you know, outages, you're just kind of like, I don't have to worry about them. You know, it's like Joe, our buddy
Emerson.
Joe Emerson said, like, it's ops less. And I know people argue about that, and folks like Charity Majors have made awesome, you know, arguments about, like, hey, don't forget about ops and all this stuff. But I think, you know, as you think about those scale kind of problems, like, it is a big deal. Now, the flip side of serverless is, like, the question becomes, should it be its own system? Should you think about it as a completely different paradigm? Should you think about it as being really just an extension of what a PaaS should do? Because, you know, are you going to write entirely serverless apps? Are you going to write some mix of serverless plus things that are stateful or running containers or whatever? So I think there's some debate about that. And then I think, you know, people are going to be a little bit leery of, do I only want to do Lambda? Lambda obviously has a big head start, but, you know, we've seen like OpenWhisk out there. Azure has Functions, and that's grown pretty rapidly. And nobody's marketed their serverless like the Lambda guys have. But I think that's going to be another big thing, because I'm already hearing stuff from companies who are like, I think I might like serverless, but I'd like it on-prem. And it's like, you almost want to go like, do you really? Do you think you can do that? Do you lose all the
exactly
operational benefit of it?
Is. Yeah. You know, the Amazon, the AWS Greengrass thing, that's exactly what that is, right? Yeah. Yeah. And what's interesting for me,
well, it's also what Snowmobile is. Greengrass
right.
is tiny,
right.
Snowmobile is the big version.
Right. And what's interesting too is like, okay, if we, at the end of the day, serverless is nothing more than another way to do plumbing. The way containers is plumbing, the way VMs is plumbing, serverless is another way. It's another tool in the toolbox to do plumbing. Well, what does it enable? Let's, you know, go up a second, and that goes into our next prediction of, you know, where is tech going? It's all about AI. It's all about machine learning. And yeah. For me, serverless enables the AI and machine learning. And like, I'm super interested in, okay, it makes me really look forward to, I'm coming up in March, the next Google conference, the GCP Next conference in March.
Yeah.
You know, what are they going to announce? Because they announced Google Functions. Are they going to do more with that? are they going to actually, you know, make that kind of the underpinnings of their AI and machine learning? Certainly the way, you know, Lambda and Alexa are going together on the AWS side. And so there's very different ways to think about AI and machine learning. Like, we've always traditionally thought about it. And if you look at like the Google keynote from last year, at least my take on it, it'd be interesting to see what your thoughts on it. But it was still very much like data scientists, data lakes, and like really big picture, big things, as opposed to, you're starting to see a personalization of it, you know, human interaction on a consumer level. This is, you know, this is awful in a, you know, first world problems kind of thing, right? But, you know, I just got the Alexa recently, and like after playing with it for a while, it's like, gosh, this is so nice. I couldn't be bothered to pull my phone out of my pocket anymore and type stuff in, which is awful. But it's like, and I'll be sitting in my car going, damn it, I just wish I could tell Alexa to, you know, play the radio or do these other things. Right. And yeah, you could do it with Siri and some of these others. But so far, the Alexa has been a superior platform for something like that. But, you know, is this a race for like building the biggest data sets? Is this a race for the best algorithms? Like, how do you advance and differentiate and become the market leader in AI and machine learning going forward?
Yeah, and I think it brings up a really interesting question from an enterprise perspective. So, you know, you think about startups and so forth. So, I don't know, your Instagram or your, you know, SoundCloud or, you know, anybody like that, who it's like you're generating sort of net new amounts of data about your marketplace that you are always going to keep in the public cloud because that's where your service was run. It'll be really interesting to see if you know, some of the banking industry, the automotive industry, the farming industry, pharma, you know, whatever, like in order, I mean, they have massive data warehouses, but they're not in the cloud. And in order to sort of marry these AI services, these machine learning services, like you've got to put the data in some local proximity to be able to, you know, query over it. And so it'll be interesting, you know, does Google have a massive advantage that they've been able to take their search queries, turn that into healthcare type of data or something other data, and offer that as a service that's you know, better than the banks, better than the healthcare companies or whatever? Or do we see, you know, the healthcare companies, the you know, all these guys like having to move their data into the cloud? Because nobody really offers like an on-prem version of these things, right? So I think it becomes a, you know, data proximity and who has the data, how do you get to the data, and can you turn that data into anything that becomes monetizable or a business differentiating service? Like, that's the big deal. And we hear all these services that are like, here's the front end of the service. I think the back end of the service is the really interesting part of it. And, but it, of course it's the hard part too. So it's, you know, it's going to get less talked about at least initially, because you don't want to depress people about being like, well, there's no data to query on.
Right.
You know,
I mean, like, well, and one that's, I think is a prime example, but it hasn't necessarily, you know, consumers benefit from it, but it hasn't reached the consumer level, is you look at like IBM Watson and the medical, consulting that medical, that, right. Excuse me, that doctors can, you can actually now go buy Watson services, and apparently it's outrageously expensive, but you could basically feed a bunch of patient data into Watson, and Watson will almost serve as either a primary or secondary opinion to the doctors. And something like that is fascinating, because what they've done is they've taken something as powerful as Watson and they've started to monetize that service and offer it to certain select markets.
Yeah. But I mean, there's a long way for this to go. I mean, in reality, like, you know, what you want to have as a service is something like, you know, whatever my provider is, here's my DNA, go get that from 23andMe, right? Get my DNA history. I'm going to, you know, through an Alexa thing, say, hey, Alexa, I just went to Wendy's, or Alexa, I ate this for lunch today, and have it basically say, like, you know what, you're trending towards diabetes and you need to do this, or you're trending towards cancer because your family, like, you want it to somehow tell you something that's tangible, right? Like, replace what a doctor would tell you, or, you know, give you it. Like, we're nowhere near that kind of stuff. Like, it's 10 steps to get you something like that, or, yep. You know, or, hey, dummy, your planning to run in the Krispy Kreme in 2 months. Like, here's what you need to do. Get up today, go run, you know, whatever that might be. So yeah, it's super fascinating. Absolutely. I'm looking forward to the A Cloud Guru guys, being able to do the, AI and machine learning, training stuff. Cause I'd like to learn how to make that
absolutely
work.
Yeah. So let's skip ahead to kind of topic number two here. So let's go talk about the economy for a little bit.
Yep.
VC funding has been down.
Yeah. We'll talk about that.
Do we see fire sale acquisitions? Do we see, you know, Oracle picking the bones of more companies? Do we see down rounds? Like, what do you think is going to happen here? And in my mind, and it'll kind of go ahead to the other topics we could explore it more in a second, but it almost seems like, you know, the VC markets have shifted away from what we typically talk about on the show. So, you know, a combination of VC funding is down, but I also think VC funding has shifted as well.
Yeah, I think it's two things. I think they're shifting into things that are more in that data space that we just talked about, because they're realizing where the eventual value will come from. And then I think the other interesting part becomes, what will be the success of these things going private equity? Because we've seen a lot of companies in our space. I mean, Citrix has gone into the private equity space. Dell, obviously, you know, there's been rumors about, Juniper's had, you know, some of those guys. I mean, people have called for Cisco, because basically these companies sit on a lot of cash. They're still viable businesses, but they're not necessarily innovative businesses anymore. So I think that's going to be interesting. And then to figure out, like, do you just run as a private equity company forever, or are they hoping to get out? Because we haven't seen the big spin out of those companies yet. We haven't seen them go back to being IPO. We haven't seen them really getting chopped up yet. That seems to happen at the beginning. That to me is almost more interesting, especially if the VC funding moves away from our core industry into other stuff, you know, autonomous cars or machine learning or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and what I see this is, you almost have this new, and don't get me wrong, it's probably not new, but for me new of, yeah, VC funding, certain amount of rounds, you either get bought, you IPO, you go under. If you IPO, you exist as a public company and you're living quarter to quarter. And then when you can't show those results anymore, and when you don't become as innovative anymore, then you go into the private equity, and then you kind of have the long tail of just milk that cash cow as long as you can. And then maybe you eventually split it off and sell off the parts, right? And maybe that is the new tech company long tail, 10, 15, 20 years of some of these companies that make it that long. Because what are you know, the ones we're starting to see most that are going into this are the companies that have been around for a long time. And they may not necessarily, we've talked about it a couple times now, you know, what are going to be the big vendors in the next 10 years? Like, you can almost say, like, generations of, like, okay, once upon a time, it was like Xerox and NCR and some of these other companies, and none of them are around anymore. And then you went to, you know, Dell and HP and IBM and some of these other companies, and a certain amount of these companies, just like you look at, you know, the, you know, Fortune,
they don't survive the next 100 generation.
They don't survive, right? They don't survive the next iteration. And so what you're starting to see is what is going to be the next iteration of the big companies. Is it Microsoft, Google, Salesforce, AWS? And do the folks like HP, Cisco, IBM, Oracle, VMware, are they faced with a challenge going forward? And that to me is very interesting, to watch this natural progression of the next rise of the next set of tech companies. And some will survive, some will, you know, try to survive, some will reinvent themselves completely, and some will just cruise along and continue to milk things until they can't anymore.
Yeah. I think there's another interesting thing for people to watch is going to be, and this may have been a totally innocuous comment or whatever, but I thought it was interesting that Adrian Cockcroft made the comment during the last reInvent keynote was, you know, we were sitting there, they were announcing some feature. It was a, you know, basically kill off the ecosystem kind of feature, or, you know, overlap the ecosystem kind of feature.
There goes another diamond sponsor.
And Adrian sort of said, like, hey, instead of, you know, going through the whole VC market, your own company, like, come start a thing at AWS, like build your company as a service of AWS. And And I think it'll be interesting because we've always seen the largest vendors who have been able to pick off their ecosystem and put a feature into their platform, right? That's always the problem of being a small company that's kind of one or two features that could become a platform. And we've also seen, you know, the big companies will acquire stuff, right? That's normal. And AWS and Azure and others are still kind of acquiring companies. But it will be interesting to see if they kind of do some sort of VC spin-in kind of thing, you know, kind of analogous to what Cisco did for all those years where they find, you know, people that they know, they trust, they let them go off, but they spin them back in and they, you know, pay them in a way that's better than just being a regular employee. And I think that's going to be another thing to watch is like, do you want to be a VC, you know, do you want to be a startup outside of an ecosystem, or do you want to sort of be inherently embedded in an ecosystem from day one? And what does that mean? Can you make enough money? Do you enjoy the autonomy? All that sort of stuff. I think that's going to be interesting to see if AWS, Azure, Google, some of the others kind of spawn off those kind of programs for you know, and replace startups to a certain extent, or replace VC funding to a certain extent.
Agreed. And you know, if we bring it away from the vendor side for a second and over to the customer side, I think the other big trend is this really moves into, okay, if the economy goes bad, who benefits, right? There's always going to be a beneficiary, right? Is that the SaaS companies going forward? Is it, you know, everything starts to shift to OpEx versus CapEx, and we start to see a lot of companies only doing the pay as you go, only pay for what you need, always looking to kind of right size your spend.
Yeah.
Does that fundamentally change? Does a you know, a bad economy or potentially bad economy fall into certain buying types and certain buying patterns, and the way in which we actually consume everything will be fundamentally changed going forward. You know, like you look at, yeah, you mentioned it on yesterday's show, you know, Office 365, right? And no one is buying Office anymore, and no one is loading Office anymore. And you know, Microsoft has done a very successful transition from one model to the other model. And are other companies going to embrace that? And if they don't, what happens to them?
Right. Yeah, no, it's an interesting thing. The only kind of good data point or analogy I can kind of recall from, say, 2008 was, you know, I remember I was at NetApp and we basically just started pushing like crazy this idea of data deduplication, which was at the time kind of a while. I mean, basically we told people like, you should buy less storage coming from a storage company. And at the time that sounded kind of crazy, but it was exactly what people kind of wanted to hear during a downtime, right? Oh, I'm going to spend less, but I'm going to get sort of, you know, my demand hasn't gone anywhere, but I'd like to spend less. Now, that only really kind of benefited them for a short period of time until the economy kind of got healthy again. You know, will things move to more to public cloud if the economy goes bad? I don't know, because there's not, you know, like there's not an easy button today that says, you know, take my whatever application and move it to the public cloud, at least at an IaaS level. You know, we may see some people get really creative about, you know, here's how you move this stuff to a SaaS application, and people may buy into that. And if they can get out of their, you know, their enterprise licensing to more of a per seat licensing or something like that may happen. But, you know, I think when you're talking about big applications, it's just harder to say immediately like, oh, they will just get swept in one direction because their budgets are lower.
Well, and will we see ultimately a downsizing of our industry in general? You know, what used to be, I don't know, $10 in IT infrastructure spend is now $1. Whether that's HCI, whether that's SaaS, whether that's public cloud, you know, no matter what it is, will the $10 turn into $1 going forward? And that's just the new normal.
Yeah. And I think we're going to see, it'd be interesting to see if the shift happens from, say, like vendors downsizing, customers downsizing their staff, or if we see, you know, more people having to shift over to, you know, kind of somewhere in the supply chain, right? Do they become work at VARs, SIs, or, you know, do we see some of these cloud providers? I mean, we saw a big thing at reInvent where, you know, SIs and cloud and, you know, integrators were sort of front and center. So, you know, tech is a funny thing. It's, it's not always easy to just replace with a push of a button. Like there is a lot of work that has to go on sometimes to integrate and make things happen. And, but people will shift to which role and then obviously like how much you get paid in that ecosystem. So definitely something to keep an eye on for folks.
Yep.
Well, let's listen, we could go through a whole lot of these different ones. I think we're getting sort of close to the end and we're coming up on an hour. Let's hit on this last one. We sort of said politics might be a third topic and, you know, we don't want this show to be political. We've never made it about political views, but I think with the new, you know, administration coming into play, it does bring up a couple of interesting questions and especially around cloud. The first one I'll sort of throw out there or that I've been thinking about, you know, as we're looking at kind of how, for example, you know, President-elect Trump uses the new media and he uses Twitter. You know, he's been kind of poking at some of the defense industry and we saw one of the companies, you know, stock went way down because he sort of sent a negative tweet. You know, do we think, especially with Amazon being as dominant as they are, does he potentially go after Amazon? You know, we've seen him call out Jeff Bezos before. Jeff Bezos owns the Washington Post, who's been very critical of him. You know, is that something that, that people should be keeping an eye on?
I would say, first of all, absolutely. But I'd also add to the probably one of the funniest things. So for those that don't know, you know, the President-elect Trump had a almost tech summit, if you will, had a lot of the CEOs of very prominent tech companies, and Jeff Bezos was there. And there was this meme that went around of like, you know, Bezos just basically looking like a captive in the room of like, and it was this, you know, beginning of 2016 and it's him on stage and laughing and happy. And then the end of 2016 and it's him just looking with this just horrible, horrible face of, and just looking borderline scared. Right. And don't get me wrong. I don't know that that was that. That was probably just a funny picture taken at the time. And it really made me laugh. But I think all of the tech companies have something to fear out of all of this, because exactly what you were saying, you not only have a president here that maybe has slightly different views and policies, but also can, yeah, take out a stock with a, you know, 140 characters. I mean, right. That is genuinely scary.
Yeah.
And it is unprecedented in our industry. And it is going to be a shift in how the next couple years will develop.
Yeah, no, I think I mean, the tech industry as a whole probably has to, it's kind of a double-edged sword because to some extent, you know, as a country, you want to be strong in technology. You know, the greatest countries in history have always been sort of strong in whatever the latest technology is. But at the same time, you know, tech in particular isn't super friendly to jobs. I mean, but there are lots of people that we know that have jobs in tech, but tech tends to be about automating things and driving better productivity. And this is a administration that's run on trying to bring jobs back, at least to the United States. And so that's going to be an interesting kind of give and take of like, you know, you look at autonomous vehicles, you look at, you know, these stores that are no longer going to have, you know, cashiers, and you look at, you know, drone delivery and, you know, getting rid of truck driving jobs. And it's going to be very interesting to see how the tech industry manages that. It'll be interesting to see how lobbyists and so forth are pushing things. Cause it is an interesting sort of yin and yang of be good at technology, but you know, what does that do to the overall economy of the people that you serve?
Yeah. And you take the autonomous vehicles for a second. You look at, so Uber, so this will be a very timely portion of the podcast here. I want to even say it might have been today, but it was in the last couple of days. Uber, you know, was catching some flack in California for, doing a pilot program of their driverless cars in California, and California kind of came down on them pretty hard and wanted them to apply for autonomous license. And if they apply for that, then they have to do a lot more reporting. And if their car's ever in an accident, there's a lot more ramifications of something like that. And so, you know, the governor of Arizona reached out to him and was basically like, hey, come over to Arizona. It's great over here.
Yeah.
and Uber packed up all their cars and shipped them to Arizona. And they're now going to do the pilot in Arizona. So what you're starting to see is, and this goes into another area, is this the first step in a larger, you know, draining of the bucket, if you will? And we've talked about the Silicon Valley bubble and this reality distortion field of is the Silicon Valley very different from the rest of the world? You're starting to see this over and over where you see somebody in Arizona going, nope, you know, bring your innovation over here. And, you know, another example of that is my company, or at least my business unit, is based out of Boulder, Colorado. And just in the last couple of years, you're seeing a huge exodus of Silicon Valley to Boulder. You have AWS opened up a couple offices there. Google is building a huge building there. Bing has offices there. There's quite a number of other startups that have opened small offices there. Numerous reasons behind something like that. Obviously, you can get, you know, maybe cheaper talent. You can avoid the crazy housing market. But you know, are we starting to see that as a trend? And will something like that happen over the next couple of years of this kind of encouraging folks to work and live for various reasons outside of the major tech areas? Or are we, you know, potentially building other major tech areas within the country?
Yeah, no, I think that's going to be a huge thing to watch. You know, where do tax incentives go? Where do tax breaks go in certain states? Are they competing to get those types of things? The other thing, and I'll sort of maybe wrap this up on a last one, and this one's kind of weird, but I wonder if it'll come into play. Like, you know, people talk about fake news, right? And kind of trying to manipulate the message and the story that's what's out there, and whether it's fake or whether it's manipulated. You know, at the end of the day, tech is a very competitive industry. It's driven by a lot of sort of marketing noise and a lot of things. Like, I wonder if we will see some tech companies who will sort of try and pick up on this and create their equivalent of sort of fake tech news and come up with pundits that are going to kind of tell you that, you know, their technology, their trends, especially if we're getting into, you know, the intersection of business and technology being more so. I think it's going to be interesting to watch that, right? We saw a whole cycle of it around, you know, political statements and stuff, but will we see it around, you know, does this tech work? Does this tech not work? Is this, you know, should you be investing in this? It'll be interesting to see if, you know, there is a company out there that tries to take the lead in doing stuff like that. Because we know the platform's there via Facebook and other stuff. It'll be interesting to see if that happens.
Yeah, makes sense. I hadn't even thought about that one. I'm like, oh, wow.
Yeah. So, you know, flash storage doesn't really work. It's not as cheap, whatever it is.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
Well, listen, man, we've been going for a long time here. I think it was a very good year for us. You know, some ups and downs and lots of things happened in 2016. First off, thank you to everybody who listens to the show. Thank you to everybody who tells a friend and helps us grow it. We still love doing the show. You know, we'll sort of reiterate again, we would love to have you make a donation, big, small, you know, $1, $5, $1 million, you know, to the Krispy Kreme Challenge. We love being able to contribute to helping those kids. It's the one thing that we ask people, in exchange for us doing this show every week. So if you get a chance, you know, you go to thecloudcast.net, there's a big button on the right, with a donut and somebody running, just click on it. And if you can open up your wallet and be a little bit generous, we would love that. Aaron, any last minute, words for 2016 or things to look forward to in 2017?
No, I would say, yeah, combination of very mixed feelings for 2016. You know, from a podcast standpoint, I mean, it's been an incredible year. And so thank you very much to everyone out there. It has been great, received a lot of great feedback, and we are constantly tweaking and tuning and trying to constantly make this better. And so we would love to hear your feedback as well on that. But yeah, as far as the rest of 2016, yeah, we just need to get this year over with. Jesus Christ.
Yeah, it's been a year.
So on that note, no, I would say absolutely. Thank you, everyone. Thank you for listening. And we look forward to certainly a great 2017 and really looking forward to where the tech is taking us. And hopefully we'll be able to explore lots of new areas and bring you some great guests next year. So looking forward to 2017.
Great. All right, man. We'll let it go. And folks, we'll see you in 2017. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to The Cloudcast. Please visit thecloudcast.net to find more shows, show notes, videos, and everything social media.